This is Sarah Stewart Holland.
This is Beth Silvers.
You're listening to Pantsuit Politics,
where we take a different approach to the news. Hi, friends. It's Elise, the managing director of the show. I am recording this at 3:30 Eastern on Monday afternoon. It feels important to timestamp that because it has already been a whirlwind of a week. From the attempted assassination of Donald Trump on Saturday, to Judge Eileen Cannon throwing out the classified documents case, to the announcement of J.D. Vance as Trump's vice presidential candidate. And now, by the time you are hearing this, we are in the thick of RNC convention week. Sarah and Beth are both overseas, as you know from our episode earlier this week that they recorded in their respective hotel bathrooms in the middle of the night for us here in the States. Normally, when we do our summer break, knowing they'll be gone, we record in advance a variety of conversations we hope will be relevant and interesting for you during that break. Even though we already brought you a regular episode earlier this week and we'll bring you another one on Friday, we did not want to wait any longer to bring you today's conversation. Oftentimes, we would put a conversation like this on our premium channel, but it feels so relevant and so right for this moment that we wanted everyone to have it today. So if you do enjoy it, I hope that it'll inspire you to join our premium community if you're not there already, and also to check out the massive archive of great content that we already have there and the new stuff that we're releasing every week. Today, we're bringing you a conversation with Jeff Friedman, Associate Professor of Government at Dartmouth College and author of The Commander-in-Chief Test, Public Opinion and the Politics of Image-Making in U.S. Foreign Policy. Beth spoke with Professor Friedman back in the spring, and a variety of current events meant we held onto it longer than we had originally intended. But I think you will concur that this is the moment the conversation was meant for. It feels so right for this week. In his book, Professor Friedman makes the case that voters say one thing and mean another when it comes to presidents and foreign policy. They say they want presidents who keep us out of conflicts and play it safe, but what they really mean is they want a president who looks strong and independent and will passionately pursue American interests abroad. We find that that rings very true as the Republican Party this week nominates Donald Trump for a third consecutive time. Before we share that conversation, I wanted to remind you that we are booking speaking events for the fall. We are coming down to the wire for any final bookings for the fall. I happen to know that our inquiries have jumped up in the last few weeks, so if you have any interest in getting Sarah and Beth to come speak in person or virtually, please reach out to us ASAP via our website or by emailing us at hello@pantsuitpoliticsshow.com. I am confident you will be very glad you did. Just like the folks at Abilene Christian University, they've had them on campus twice in the past few years. And after their most recent visit, they said, "The way that Sarah and Beth were able to articulate conversation was unlike anything I have ever witnessed before. They were asked some very direct questions, but with no hesitation, responded with grace and peace while providing a perspective I had not even considered. We needed an event like this, and they exceeded my expectations." We love getting those ringing endorsements and would love to have Sarah and Beth come be with your group, your school, your company, your institution, whatever it may be. So please do reach out if you want to have Sarah and Beth join you yet this fall or to snag a 2025 spot while their schedules are still relatively open, although we are in conversations about 2025 already as well. Thank you so much for listening. We hope this conversation with Jeff Friedman feels helpful to you, feels relevant to you, and that you feel like I do, that it's just right for this moment. Sarah and Beth will be back in your ears on Friday with another brand new episode of our Nuance Life Revival. Until then, have the very best week available to you.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front payment equivalent to $15 per month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Taxes and fees extra. Speeds slower above 40 gigabytes in detail.
This is Jen and Jess from the beauty podcast Fat Mascara.
The most common skin question we hear from our listeners is about how to treat eye aging.
Our recommendation, Shiseido Benefiance Wrinkle Smoothing Eye Cream, which targets five types of eye area wrinkles, inner corner, under eye, crow's feet, around eye, and frown lines.
Plus, it helps to treat dark circles and eye bag puffiness too.
No two people experience eye aging the same way, and Shiseido Benefiance Wrinkle Smoothing Eye Cream helps no matter what your eye concerns are.
If you're not seeing results from your current eye cream, now is the time to try Shiseido Benefiance Wrinkle Smoothing Eye Cream.
Find Shiseido at an Ulta Beauty store near you.
Hi, this is Jonathan Fields, host of The Good Life Project, where each week I talk to listeners about investing in their future by increasing their own vitality. But when it comes to those financial goals, whether it be saving for a home renovation, growing your child's college fund, or travel, life can make it difficult to stay the course. By working with a dedicated Merrill advisor, you get a personalized plan and a clear path forward. Having the bull at your back helps your whole financial life move with you. So when your plans change, Merrill's with you every step of the way. Go to ml.com/bullish to learn more. Merrill, a Bank of America company. What would you like the power to do? Investing involves risk. Merrill Lynch, Pierce Fenner & Smith Incorporated, registered broker-dealer, registered investment advisor, member SIPC.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
From almost 9 years of Making Pantsy Politics, we know that there are a range of philosophies and relationships to faith in our audience, and we're so grateful for that. We also know that many of you have come up in the Christian tradition and would like to find ways to hold on to that, but have kind of it's complicated status with your faith. And that is why our listener, Michelle, started her business, The Grateful Goose. She wants to be part of creating a world where everyone, no matter who they love or what they look like, can feel welcome and accepted and embraced. So the Graceful Goose has the perfect baby shower or baptism gifts, like the Blessing Bear with a hidden pocket that you can fill with notes from loved ones. They offer Bible study boxes. You can get those just one at a time, or you can subscribe monthly, and you'll have topics like faith in nature and women of the Bible. Michelle and her team have brought so much thoughtfulness to making it easy for parents and caregivers to introduce their kids to an inclusive, loving God and a faith full of wonder. Visit thegracefulgoose.com today and find your safe space for faith and 20% off on your first purchase with the code PANTSUIT. That's thegracefulgoose.com and use code PANTSUIT. And in doing so, you will also be connecting with another member of our Pantsuit Politics community.
Jeff, thank you so much for talking with me about the Commander-in-Chief test. I did not pick up this book expecting to come away thinking, well, here is what Donald Trump has in common with John F. Kennedy. So it's very illuminating in that way.
I appreciate that. Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit about your central thesis here, this issue image trade-off that exists around foreign policy for presidents?
Sure. So the book asks how voters decide who's fit to be commander-in-chief and how those choices shape the politics of U.S. foreign policy. And the basic idea of the book is that when voters think about which presidential candidates are best suited to lead the country in international affairs, they care partly about whether those leaders have policy platforms that appeal to them on the merits, but they're much more interested in making sure that they elect a president who's got the right personal attributes to be a competent commander-in-chief, and in particular, someone who seems like a strong leader who will stand up to America's adversaries and advocate for the country's interests. And the book also explains how voters often have to make trade-offs between candidates who seem to have appealing policy platforms and those who seem to have the right stuff to be commander-in-chief. And the book essentially argues that when faced with that choice, voters will generally gravitate towards electing leaders based on their personal images, particularly leaders who seem strong and tough and decisive. And I argue that that trade-off steers U.S. foreign policy in a direction that tends to be more hawkish than what voters actually want.
So my husband saw me reading your book and asked what it was about. And I said, well, I think the thesis here is that you would say to a voter, should we invade Iraq? The voter would say, absolutely not. And then you would say, would you like to vote for someone who says we absolutely should not invade Iraq? And they would say, no, I would not. So even though we tend to be a more peace-loving people, we like leaders who talk the tough talk. And that creates this kind of perverse incentive. Am I getting it?
Yeah, that's exactly it. And so one good recent example of that is that when President Biden decided to withdraw from Afghanistan, polls showed that a majority of voters agreed with him, or at the very least, voters seemed to be divided evenly on the merits of that choice. But after Biden went through with that plan and the Taliban took control of Afghanistan, Biden's approval ratings really tanked. And so that's a place in which I think the cost that policy had to Biden's image went way beyond what voters thought about that action on its merits. And to give you another example, you mentioned John F. Kennedy. When John F. Kennedy ran for president in 1960, the centerpiece of his foreign policy platform was proposing to raise defense spending by a substantial amount. That was the origins of his inaugural address promise to pay any price, bear any burden to advance liberal internationalism. At the time, less than a quarter of Americans said they thought the defense budget was too small, but they really liked the way Kennedy sounded when he talked about raising the defense budget. It made him seem strong and vigorous. It allowed him to portray the incumbent Eisenhower administration as being weak and complacent. And so it's exactly the examples of these trade-offs between policies that voters are skeptical of on their merits and versus leaders who sound strong and tough and decisive and give voters the image that they want from a commander in chief.
I was really preoccupied while reading with this question of how rational this is.
Yeah.
I think it's fair for voters to feel like we don't really know what the substance of foreign policy decisions should be. And we can evaluate toughness or strength in our leaders. So what do you think about that?
That's a great question. I'd actually be interested to hear your views. But I think this comes from a reasonable instinct. The substance of foreign policy is really complicated. We can't expect voters to develop firm views about the merits of every foreign policy choice. And in principle, you'd think it would be much easier for voters to intuitively assess the personal attributes of their leaders. I mean, every one of us every day evaluates the character and the traits of people around us. So I think at some level, it seems like voters should do a better job evaluating these traits. But I think in practice, we have to recall that presidential candidates are experts in image crafting. And they have really large teams of professionals who are designed to help them convey the personal image that will resonate with American voters. And leaders can be really, really cynical about crafting those images, even if that steers U.S. foreign policy away from what voters want on the merits. And so I think part of what the book is trying to do is cause us to question our gut instincts, that we feel like we know these presidential candidates. We feel like we can assess whether they have the right stuff to be commander in chief. And we might be placing too much, perhaps much too much emphasis on that element of their candidacy. That's not to say that their personal attributes don't matter at all. Just that I think we exaggerate how much we can assess them and we underestimate the costs that has for U.S. foreign policy.
The piece that I am kind of struggling with when I think about whether we're behaving rationally as voters is something that we talked to Hillary Clinton about back in December. So we had Secretary Clinton on to talk about Israel and Gaza. And we were discussing with her how diplomacy is greatly undervalued by the American public because it is largely unseen and it mostly acts in a preventative way. It's hard for voters to think, wow, I'm really grateful for what didn't happen. For good reasons, we don't know all of the horribles that are being prevented out there in the world. And I wonder how that fits into your sort of thesis about strength demonstrated by hawkish foreign policy versus good judgment demonstrated by a more dovish foreign policy. That we simply cannot appreciate the dovish foreign policy because we don't see all of it.
I think that's a big part of it. But part of what I talk about in the book is that even if voters care about attributes besides strong leadership, and particularly they want leaders who have good judgment for evaluating foreign policy decisions. Good judgment is just so complicated and it's context dependent and it's nuanced and it's really hard for candidates to convey that sort of thing directly. If you look at public opinion polls, They show that voters generally support taking multilateral approaches to international affairs. They want the United States to be sharing the burden of global leadership with allies. They say they don't like unilateral approaches to the world. But the problem is when you actually conduct diplomacy, it's complicated and involves making concessions. And these deals are difficult to evaluate. And it's really easy for critics to say that these are bad deals that represent the United States letting other countries walk all over them. So that's hard. Diplomacy is tough. It's complicated. Voters can't evaluate the merits of that easily. But by contrast, if you stand up to your adversaries, if you say, I'm not going to back down, if you confront them with force, if you reject deals, that is just a much easier way to communicate that you're a strong leader. And I think that's one reason why many presidents before Joe Biden made the political calculation not to withdraw from Afghanistan. And many presidents besides before Barack Obama made the calculation not to try to make deals with adversaries like Iran, because even if voters kind of agree with the principle of what you're doing, once you get down to the brass tacks, it's really easy for critics to say that you're being weak. Whereas candidates like Donald Trump, who are very brash about standing up to America's adversaries, have a much easier path to communicating that they're strong leaders in a way that voters will appreciate.
How much of this is just about drawing contrast? I'm talking to you a few minutes after Nikki Haley suspended her presidential campaign. And I noticed in her remarks, it was kind of a confusing speech because she didn't endorse anyone. She just suspended her own campaign. But she talked about things that are important to her. And on foreign policy, she said that America must lead in the world. We will have more violence and more conflicts if America doesn't lead. And I don't know if that was supposed to be a contrast to Donald Trump or Joe Biden or both of them, but it made me think about the Vietnam case studies in your book, where there were distinctions without much of a difference in how candidates really viewed what was happening. But it is just so tempting to contrast yourself with your opponents by saying, well, I would go harder at this.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a great analogy. So the Vietnam cases in the book look at particularly the 1968-1972 elections. In 1968, Richard Nixon and Hubert Humphrey drew very few policy contrasts about what to do on Vietnam. And part of the reason for that was that because the country was so sick of Johnson's leadership on the war, and because Hubert Humphrey seemed at the time to be a relatively weak leader who was sort of tied to the Johnson administration, Richard Nixon had no incentive to say how he'd handle the war differently. Voters already trusted that he would handle the war better than Hubert Humphrey. So he didn't have any reason to draw a clear policy contrast because the image contrast already favored him. And I think that also another reason he sort of underplays the substantive side of how he's going to handle Vietnam is that it was not clear on the merits what he could do differently that voters would like. So I think that kind of sort of vague image posturing where you're saying, I'm going to be a better leader without providing the details of what that better leadership will entail is a really consistent pattern throughout U.S. foreign policy. And it's part of the reason why I think voters get undersupplied with diplomatic solutions that they say they want. Leaders are quite intelligently making this calculation that if they get into the weeds, they start talking about the compromises that they're going to have to make, they're going to expose themselves to challenges for being weak, for giving in. That's going to harm the image that they want to project of being a confident commander-in-chief.
You can tell me if this is an unfair question, because your book is very meticulous about this is the way that I am analyzing the data. This is what counts as good research methods. So tell me if this is unfair because it's so recent. But if you were writing now a study of Biden and Trump on Ukraine, I wonder what you would pull out of their campaigns in this situation that we find ourselves in.
It's a great question. Donald Trump is unusual in the sense that he's able to maintain a reputation for being this tough, aggressive leader, despite arguing that we need to retrench many aspects of U.S. interventions and engagements around the world. Ukraine is a clear one. Republicans would normally take a much more hawkish position on Ukraine, whereas Trump wants to back down. So the question is, how is it that Trump's able to do that? And I think part of the way he's able to get away with this and avoid being criticized for backing down to Russia or being a weak leader is that he's couching the reasons why we need to pull out of Ukraine as under this America First rubric, that Biden is sort of not being sufficiently vigorous about sticking up for American interests in devoting all these resources to Ukraine, Whereas instead, in Trump's view, we need to devote those towards protecting the southern border. And so I think because Trump is saying that the Ukraine investment is preventing the United States from standing up for its interests elsewhere, he's able to retain that notion of being hawkish and be standing up for American interests. Whereas I think by contrast, when Biden withdrew from Afghanistan, that was more of a pure retrenchment. And he wasn't saying we need to do this in order to spend resources elsewhere. He was saying it's just a bad investment per se. And I think that's part of why that was easy for his opponents to portray as backing down as opposed to reinforcing an America first image. In general, I think that one of the underappreciated elements of Trump's political success is that Americans see this America first foreign policy as something that indicates that Trump is willing to stand up for America more than his predecessors. And even though Americans overwhelmingly say they don't like unilateral approaches to foreign policy, I think they really appreciate a commander-in-chief who seems like they're big, tough, strong, and vigorous. So Trump's America First foreign policy is like an archetypal example of these trade-offs between images and issues. Voters aren't super thrilled with unilateralism, but they'll take it if it means they can get a commander-in-chief who's going to stick up for America's interests. And I think that's a big part of how Trump has convinced many voters that he belongs in the White House.
Ryan Reynolds here for, I guess, my 100th Mint commercial. No. I mean, honestly, when I started this, I thought I only have to do like 4 of these. I mean, it's unlimited premium wireless for $15 a month. How are there still people paying 2 or 3 times that much? I'm sorry, I shouldn't be victim blaming here. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch whenever you're ready.
$45 upfront payment equivalent to $15 per month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Taxes and fees extra. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes. See details.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Calling all romance lovers. If you read 50 Shades of Grey or Beach Read or The Spanish Love Deception, I have the perfect app for you. If you do what I do, you like save the entire open door scene in your Kindle highlights, or you fire up that scene from The Notebook on YouTube over and over again, but you don't have to do that anymore. Now there's Dipsy. Dipsy is the female-founded app for spicy audiobooks and more, created by women for women. Their app has over 1,000 spicy audiobooks, all crafted by a team of professional writers and top-tier narrators. Whether you're looking for a rugged cowboy or a Scottish sailor, fey royalty, or the god of the underworld, you'll find characters you love on Dipsy. With their easy-to-explore app, you can search for your favorite romance genre like contemporary, historical, dark, sports, western, romanticy, sapphic, everything. New chapters are released every week, so you'll always find something new to enjoy. For listeners of the show, Dipsy is offering an extended 30-day free trial when you go to dipsystories.com/pantsuit. That's 30 days of full access for free when you go to dipsestories.com/pantsuit. dipsystories.com/pantsuit.
Our next sponsor is one of my go-to reads when it comes to understanding how the day's current events impact me and my family and our work here at Pantsuit Politics. Today, we are sponsored by The Washington Post. Right now, go to washingtonpost.com/pantsuit, and you can subscribe for just 50 cents per week for your first year. And let me tell you, that is well worth it. Those of you who listen to the show know that we do a tremendous amount of research, and we are always going to the Washington Post on topics like Capitol Hill, the economy, climate change, foreign policy, and so much more. I really appreciate the way the Washington Post makes it clear when we're reading reported journalism versus opinion pieces. I think their website especially makes it so easy to know what you should expect when you go to a piece. I return often to their reporting, especially about elections. I appreciate their reporting on immigration very much. I think the Post does a nice job bringing a human interest perspective into their reporting. So especially when I'm thinking about how an issue feels to the people most directly affected by it, I want to go there. With the election rapidly approaching, now is the time to sign up for the Washington Post. Go to washingtonpost.com/pantsuit to subscribe for just 50 cents per week for your first year. That's 80% off their typical offer. So this is truly a steal. Once again, that's washingtonpost.com/pantsuit to subscribe for just 50 cents per week for your first year.
Most beauty brands don't understand how to balance my sensitive skin and fine hair. Either I have bouncy hair and a dry, itchy scalp, or my head feels good, but my hair is weighed down, flat, and lifeless. But Pros gets it. They have a formula that can address my sensitive skin and care for my scalp, but also gives my flat, fine hair life and bounce, which makes sense because it's based on me. If you're wondering whether custom hair care is worth the hype, let me tell you, it is. That's why I'm obsessed with Pros. Since 2017, Pros has transformed traditional hair and skincare with a made-to-order model that reduces waste, celebrates unique beauty over one-size-fits-all beauty standards, and works better than off-the-shelf alternatives. Developed in Paris and bottled fresh in Brooklyn, Pros combines the know-how of its world-class team of in-house cosmetic chemists with an advanced AI algorithm that personalizes your formula based on 80-plus unique factors. Since I switched to Pros, I've noticed that my hair is fuller, my scalp feels better, and I finally have had the courage to let my hair grow past my shoulders because I have the confidence that I don't have to choose between hair that looks good and hair that can go up in a ponytail. And because you're always changing, so is your Pros. Your formulas evolve alongside you, and Pros will address any new concerns, adjust your formula with the seasons, and learn from your feedback for an always custom fit. With Pros' review and refine tool, I've worked out a summer hair and a winter hair care routine, so even in changing seasons and weather, my hair always looks its best. Pros also offers custom skincare, so whether you're looking for stronger strands or brighter skin, it's time to discover the difference of custom hair and skincare that's made just for you. With the Pros promise, if you don't love your first order, it's on Pros. So there's never been a better time to switch to custom. Pros is so confident that you'll bring out your best hair that they're offering an exclusive trial offer of 50% off your first hair care subscription order at pros.com/pantsuit. So take your free consultation, get your one-of-a-kind formulas, and see the difference custom hair care can make with 50% off at pros, PROSE.com/pantsuit.
You mentioned in your conclusion that areas to explore in other research might be how much this issue image trade-off applies in issues like trade. And I would love to hear you talk more about that as to Trump's trade policy and to President Biden as well.
Sure. So trade is an example where deals that the United States tries to make with other countries are really complicated. They now involve innumerous kind of non-tariff barriers, environmental conditions, labor protections. These deals are just enormously difficult for anyone, let alone normal voters, to understand. Even though voters actually say that on balance, they think free trade is good for the United States, it's really easy for critics to say that various elements of these deals are making too many concessions to opponents, or that there are ways to make them better from the standpoint of the United States. It's hard for voters to know how to process that. By contrast, when someone like Donald Trump comes along and criticizes prior leaders for being too generous to other countries or that trade deals are harming Americans, that allows them to send very clear messages that they are on the side of American workers and they're going to do more than prior presidents to stick up for ordinary Americans. And I think that's another clear example where voters have to choose between saying that in principle they're proponents of a free trade regime versus a leader who seems like they've got the sort of right stuff to promote American interests more vigorously than their predecessors. So again, I think that's one reason why Trump's America First rhetoric really resonated with the public. It made it seem as though he was going to do more than President Obama to stick up for ordinary Americans. And I suspect that's one reason why President Biden has not changed a whole lot of Trump's trade legacy. I think he accurately perceives that rolling back some of the Trump restrictions would expose himself to attacks of abandoning the working class, of not sticking up for American interests. And so I think the convergence between Biden and Trump on trade is very much driven by their common need to be seen as strong leaders who are promoting the economic interests of ordinary Americans. And Biden's really explicit about that. His sort of Bidenomics idea is all about demonstrating to Americans that his foreign policy is working for the middle class.
Do you think that gender would change any of this? If we had two women running against each other for president, would any part of this issue image trade-off be different?
It's a great question. It's what I talk about sort of briefly at the end of the book. Obviously, it's hard to say. We've had no female presidents. We've had only a few top presidential contenders. So we have limited history to go on, but we can think about what that would look like. One of the messages of the book is that when voters think about who they want to be commander-in-chief, they have this ideal type image in mind, strong, tough leaders who have all sorts of attributes that we typically think of as being male-coded. So you might think that's one reason why women would struggle in order to convince Americans that they'd be competent to be commander-in-chief. That also may be one reason why female leaders like Hillary Clinton or Margaret Thatcher or Indira Gandhi often go so far out of their way to demonstrate their hawkish credentials. So you might think that that implies that female leaders would just be even more likely to follow this kind of playbook. They would have even more incentive in order to steer U.S. foreign policy in hawkish directions to demonstrate that they've got the right stuff to be commander-in-chief. But you could also imagine it going the other way, in which if voters are willing to elect female candidates, that would show that they're willing to step outside that kind of stereotypical commander-in-chief mindset. And perhaps a woman in office might have more flexibility to behave in ways that are more consistent with what voters want on the merits. So I would say, given what we've seen from presidential contenders in the past, there's lots of evidence that they are trying to adhere to this playbook. But again, it's just really hard to know. And I suspect that as we see more women running for president and getting closer and closer, and hopefully one day soon winning the presidency, we'll just get a better sense of the degree to which they have more or less freedom to change the playbook for how one thinks presidents should operate as commander-in-chief.
I love the call to action in the book to step back from this personality assessment and think more about the substance of foreign policy as we are analyzing who would be a good commander-in-chief. It reminds me a little bit of how Sarah and I have been talking about this election, where we have likely two candidates who are historically old, and how it seems to be less about them and more about their administrations. You know, when you're analyzing the potential for a president to serve all 4 years, it's almost helpful to think of the president as like the chief HR officer of the country, because who are all of these people that are going to fill the cabinet and the administration and be making really critical decisions if the worst happens to the individual? So I found that really empowering to think about the substance versus the personality. What I found depressing is how difficult it is to communicate a nuanced position, and all foreign policy is nuanced when you're being honest about it. So you have some suggestions to break out of this. Can you talk about those suggestions?
Yeah, I think there are a few things that parties and voters and candidates can do in order to break out of this ratchet effect that steers U.S. foreign policy in a hawkish direction. And all of them have to do with reassuring voters that candidates can be dovish or moderate on foreign policy without calling into question whether they're strong and tough and ready to be commander-in-chief. So one thing that parties can do is nominate leaders who have high-ranking military experience. I think one reason why Dwight Eisenhower was one of the more restrained presidents in post-Cold War history was that he could stay out of crises like the Suez Crisis without having people call into question his military leadership. He could restrain the growth of the defense budget without having voters think that he didn't know what he was doing on military issues. And that was because he came into office with a secure reputation for knowing military issues. The fact of the matter is that virtually all presidential candidates since Eisenhower haven't had that kind of reputation. So they have to earn it. And in the process of earning it, they have all these incentives in order to act tough and show their hawkish credentials. And I think parties can sidestep that if they find people with credible military experience. One thing that candidates can do is articulate restrained foreign policy positions using tough language in ways that demonstrates that they're not just backing down or being weak. That's one lesson that I think we took from Donald Trump. One of the ways that Trump was able to justify his positions of, say, withdrawing troops from the Middle East, or at least nominally when he said we would get out of Afghanistan, was that he turned his ire on the foreign policy establishment and told voters that they had sort of been hoodwinked by these establishment elites. And by showing that his foreign policies were confronting these elites, that allowed him to portray his foreign policy as standing up to someone. Might not have been the Taliban, but he was standing up to other people that voters were skeptical of. And I think that allowed him to retain some of his reputation for being tough and strong and confrontational. And then there's a simple thing that voters can do here, that if we are convinced that we're placing too much emphasis on leaders' personal attributes in ways that are distracting from the substance of foreign policies that voters say that they want, voters have perfect freedom to place more emphasis on the substance of foreign policy. And journalists and pundits have freedom to place more emphasis on describing the merits of candidates' foreign policy platforms rather than the sort of personalized talks about who's got the right stuff to sit in the Oval Office. And so I just think if we believe, as the book says, that we're exaggerating the personalized elements of this commander-in-chief test to our collective detriment, we can just change the way we talk about these issues and we can focus more on the substance. And I suspect we would all be better for that.
Here in the Silvers household, we're talking a lot about what we want our lives to feel like as we get back into a new school year. And one of our big priorities as a family is to eat dinner together more. We've done a lot of fast food in the car in past school years on our way from activity to activity. We really want to sit around our table, talk about our days, and eat delicious and nutritious food. And that's where Home Chef comes in. Home Chef's family menu has so much variety and tons of convenient options that we're actually going to be able to enjoy family time together instead of rushing through the evening after work and school and activities. Home Chef has delicious chef-prepared, oven-ready, and express meals for the entire family, even the picky eaters. Home Chef's family menu is a lifesaver, offering 4 servings at prices starting as low as $3.77 per serving. That's only $15 for an entire family meal, and they roll out 18 fresh options every week, from boneless pork chops and salmon to classics like taco kits and pizza night. For a limited time, Home Chef is offering our listeners 18 free meals. Go to homechef.com/pantsuitfam. That's homechef.com/pantsuitfam for 18 free meals. homechef.com/pantsuitfam.
We all have dreams. Dream home renovations. Dream vacations. Or sending our kids to their dream colleges. But finding straightforward ways to turn those dreams into realistic goals, that's where things get tricky. Merrill understands that. That's why, with a dedicated Merrill advisor, you get a personalized plan and a clear path forward. And having the bull at your back helps your whole financial life move with you. So when your plans change, Merrill is with you every step of the way. Go to ml.com/bullish to learn more. Merrill, a Bank of America company. What would you like the power to do? Investing involves risk. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith Incorporated, registered broker-dealer, registered investment advisor, member SIPC.
Are you into politics? Have you ever wondered about the real person behind the politician? Hi, Liz Hirschnoff-Tolley here. Tune into the Capital Coffee Connection podcast every Tuesday for a glimpse into the real lives of politicians in their own words.
I really enjoyed the book. It is such an interesting mix of scholarship and storytelling. I really liked reading about the case studies from our history. Is there one idea or question that lingers after you've hit send on publishing this book?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, I think the gender question that you raised was always lurking in the back of my mind. Again, it's just something that's hard to analyze with evidence, given that the historical record is what it is. I guess, you know, building off the last question you asked about what we can do about this, I often thought a lot in writing this book about the media environment in which we live and the degree to which it would be possible to hold more informed national conversations about the substance of foreign policy. I mean, my sense is part of the reason why these debates are so personalized is because it makes for better television. It makes for better podcasts. Like people love just talking about whether or not their political rivals or their favorite candidates have the right chops. It's just something that's much more intuitive for us to engage with. And so I suspect that there are some pretty strong incentives in the media and in presidential debates to personalize these kinds of questions. So figuring out, like, you know, what it would take to have discussions of foreign policy issues that are just more tangible, that are as easy to engage with for ordinary voters as the sort of interpersonal horse race of who's strong and who's weak. You know, and is Biden too old to be a president? It's easy to understand why that takes up so much of our collective oxygen. And so figuring out what's the alternative and how we can orient that more towards substance is something to which I really don't know the answer, but I think is a pretty pressing question given the content of the book's analysis.
I think that's really interesting. I'm thinking back to a debate question from 2016. I think Hugh Hewitt was a moderator, and he asked Donald Trump a question about the Quds forces. And it was clearly a question built to measure competence, which is a big theme in the book. How do we recognize competence among potential commanders in chief? And so I feel like the media occasionally will like dip its toes into trying to find a new path. The trouble is, the vast majority of voters don't know the Quds forces. And so I wonder how we make foreign policy more interesting just as a matter of voter education between presidential cycles so that we can have that more substance-oriented foreign policy discussion when it's election time.
I mean, another thing that you could imagine journalists and pundits doing is just asking candidates to explain the substance of their policies in more detail. I'll just give you one specific example. In the current GOP primary, virtually every well-polling GOP presidential candidate advocated attacking Mexico in order to deal with the drug cartels. And I think that is very clearly the kind of logic that's laid out in this book. It's a hawkish use of force that goes beyond what most voters say that they want on the merits, and is presumably a way for candidates without military experience like Nikki Haley or candidates with limited foreign policy experience like Ron DeSantis to show that they're big, tough, and strong. And I just think a reasonable follow-up question to that would be, what's that use of force going to look like? If you attack Mexico and the cartels don't surrender, are we going to stick around for a week, a month, years? Is this an open-ended military intervention? We're going to station troops in Mexico. And I think just sort of requiring that candidates buy the details behind these policies is a way of reorienting conversations away from, you know, your sort of first impression about how tough and strong and decisive the policies seem at a 30,000 foot level to figuring out what they actually look like and whether candidates have seriously thought them through. And I think the history of presidential campaigns is documented in the book is sort of littered with these ideas that sound nice at first, but don't really pan out the way that voters wanted. And I think we can at least chip away at that a bit by asking substantive follow-up questions and making sure that these hawkish foreign policies have some real thought behind them.
We're reading Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America with some of our listeners, and he describes the almost king-like powers that the president has over foreign policy, but doesn't worry about them too much because he says our geography will prevent America from having to become embroiled in foreign policy. The foreign policy won't really be that important. So there wasn't such a need to check the executive in this way. And it is fascinating to read your book and to see how much foreign policy shapes our elections when maybe it didn't have to be that way.
I appreciate that. Yeah, it's really interesting to hear that you're reading that with your listeners. I'm jealous.
Yeah, it's fun. It's weirdly fun. Well, thank you so much for the book and for spending some time talking with me about it.
Thanks, Beth. It was a pleasure.
Pantsuit Politics is produced by Studio D Podcast Production.
Elise Knapp is our managing director. Maggie Pinton is our director of community engagement.
Xander Singh is the composer of our theme music with inspiration from original work by Dante Lima.
Our show is listener-supported. Special thanks to our executive producers.
Martha Brunitsky.
Allie Edwards.
Janice Elliott.
Sarah Greenup.
Julie Haller.
Tiffany Hassler.
Emily Holiday.
Katie Johnson.
Emily Helen Olson.
Barry Kaufman.
Katherine Vollmer.
Lori Ladau.
Lily McClure.
Linda Daniel.
The Pettins!
Tracy Putoff.
Sarah Ralph.
Jeremy Sequoia.
Katie Steigers.
Karen True.
Annika Uvaline.
Nick and Elisa Valelli.
Amy Whited.
Lee Shay McDonough.
Morgan McHugh.
Jen Ross.
Sabrina Drigo.
Becca Dorval.
Christina Quarteraro.
Shannon Frawley.
Jessica Whitehead.
Samantha Chalmers.
Crystal Kemp.
Megan Hart.
The Rainbow Family!
The Adair Family.
Jenny Francis.
Leanna Pilgrim Larson.
The Monenet Family.
Jeff Davis, Melinda Johnston, Michelle Wood, Nicole Berkless, Paula Bremer, and Tim Miller.